Okay, welcome to episode 47 of the Guru Performance We Do Science podcast. And today's guest is Dr. Jeremy Lenneke. Hi, Jeremy.
Hi, how's it going?
I'm good, mate. I'm good. Did I pronounce your name right? Is that?
You did. That was perfect.
Well, you know, because everyone mispronounces my first name, I make some effort to at least pronounce one part of a person's name correctly. So, for the listeners who may not know who you are, do you want to just quickly give us some background about who you are, where you are, and what your basic area of research is?
Sure. I'm recently just started as an assistant professor of exercise science at the University of Mississippi. My area is muscle physiology, specifically kind of blood flow restriction area, anything with muscle function, though, really. I did my PhD work predominantly with blood flow restriction at the University of Oklahoma under Dr. Mike Benben. Worked there for 4 years. Before that, I did a master's in nutrition and exercise science at Southeast Missouri State with Dr. Joe Pujol. And I've done some internship work in a muscle phys lab up at the University of Illinois, which is where I met Lane and all those other guys, where I found blood flow restriction too, by the way.
Sure.
So that kind of set me on the whole path. But now I'm at the University of Mississippi, just trying to do science. So it's been good so far.
Yeah. So the way I came across you was sort of slightly indirect. You know, you may or may not know this about me, but my main interest is in sports and exercise nutrition. But I was also a strength and conditioning coach in my former life, and I have my own lab and would loosely describe myself as an exercise physiologist. I do a lot of metabolic testing, that sort of thing. So your area of work isn't initially what I would be interested in, but what led me to you and wanting to set up this podcast was I have started following you on Twitter for several reasons, one of which is you provide me almost every day with some sort of significant level of amusement. Your degree of sarcasm in your tweets is almost British, which I find pretty astonishing. But your sort of faithfulness to the evidence base and so on, which is something that I've really been trying to get into myself and improve my own approaches to evidence-based practice and reflective practice and that sort of thing. And if for no other reason, even if you're not into things like blood flow restriction, which we will talk about today, I highly recommend following you just for some wonderful tidbits and humor on all things science and we do science and do you even science and all that stuff. But I also know that you have some interests in nutrition, and somehow I'm going to wangle this podcast into a bit of a nutrition chat. But I guess since you are incredibly well known for your work on blood flow restriction, and you know, one only has to do a cursory search on that term, either in the scientific literature or even on Google, and your name is the one that comes up predominantly. So as someone who's a sports nutritionist or an exercise physiologist who isn't necessarily involved in training people, athletes or whatnot, they might think that they don't need to know much about blood flow restriction and its impact on training adaptations. But I have come to realize that the more I know about what my clients are trying to undertake as athletes, as members of the public, the more I can understand the mechanisms behind which, the various outcomes of the various strategies and whatnot that they're participating in allows me to further understand how I may assist that as a nutritionist. So that's kind of it. I didn't know too much about blood flow restriction, but I've read quite a few papers in the last few weeks that you've written or co-authored, and I have to admit it's fascinating and for a number of reasons. On this podcast, there's lots of people, you know, as we were discussing off air, but one area that I think has really stuck out to me is this business that there is multiple ways that you can influence training adaptations, for example, muscle hypertrophy. And we've had people like Lee Hamilton on molecular adaptations, as well as Keith Barr as well on another one. We've had Brad Schoenfeld talking about multiple concepts behind what makes muscles grow. And I know I've left lots of names out, everybody from Stu Phillips, Kevin Tipton, Lane Norton, and so on, talking about Lee Breen, sorry, and people like that, talking about, you know, leucine thresholds and so on. But it's this concept of blood flow restriction that's another potential tool in the toolbox, a strategy that I find fascinating. So before I am accused of bumbling on forever on this, could you just briefly explain to us the by way of an introduction what blood flow restriction is?
Sure. So I think it's important to realize that, you know, we're just restricting blood flow into the muscle. So we're not cutting blood flow off completely. And we're only doing this for a short period of time. So, you know, people obviously, at any time I do one of these and it gets shared, you know, there's, you know, 40 or 50 comments about how stupid I am because blood flow is important. I'm well aware that blood flow is important, okay? That was one of the first things that I considered, right? But, you know, it's such an acute stimulus, it's not chronic. So what we're doing is we're restricting blood flow. So blood flow is going into the muscle, but it's not coming out during the rest period. So essentially what it's doing is with resistance training, when you combine it with low load training, it's essentially making the muscle work a lot harder than it typically would at that load, right? So we've seen some interesting things in the literature where just applying blood flow restriction independent of muscle contraction attenuates or it might attenuate some of that muscle loss that you get from just being immobilized. It doesn't stimulate growth, but it may attenuate it or attenuate the loss. So that to me is pretty good evidence that there's something special about blood flow restriction. When we combine it with kind of a low intensity activity like slow walking, we're actually able to stimulate a small but meaningful increase in muscle size depending on the population. But typically you're not going to see a muscle growth from walking at like less than 2 miles per hour. But in some populations we've demonstrated that can stimulate a little bit of growth. But for the most robust increases in size and strength, you're going to need to combine it with low load resistance training. So low loads, meaning 20 or 30% of your max. When we've done this, we've stimulated increases in muscle size similar to that of high load training. And strength is usually similar to that as well. So the mechanisms are probably a little bit differently, are probably different all along the way. So it may be additive. We're not really sure. But there does seem to be something with just applying blood flow restriction, no muscle contraction whatsoever. You know, we've kind of hypothesized that there might be something with the cell swelling. You know, we're not sure. I mean, that's retrospective. We know that cell swelling is occurring. Is that part of what's driving that benefit? We're not sure. That's what we think, but we're not positive. But when you combine that with slow walking, you know, you're getting a little bit of a little bit more swelling, perhaps a little bit of actual mechanical tension, and that might be enough to stimulate some small increase in size and strength. But when we combine it with low load resistance training, you know, we're getting that cell swelling, we're getting that venous pulling around the muscle, we're pulling all these metabolites. So all those metabolites that get produced from training that usually get flushed out during the rest period, we're basically maintaining that inside the muscle, making it work harder and harder. So that's also augmenting the mechanical. So it may be kind of this additive thing across, but there's no question, if you want to get large increases in muscle size and strength, that's only coming from blood flow restriction in combination with resistance training. It's not coming, we're not talking about applying blood flow restriction and walking on a treadmill to stimulate massive amounts of muscle growth.
I bet you someone's doing that somewhere though.
Well, you know, that's part of the problem, okay? Yeah. And I know that you know this, people will they'll cite studies for blood flow restriction and they'll go, see, you know, I could just be walking very slowly on a treadmill and stimulate growth. It's like, that's true, depending on the population. But it's magnitude that we get from that is so much smaller than when we combine it with light weights and lift weights. So,
yeah, I think, and we've, you know, because I've talked to lots of people now this year on this podcast about these really cool things that I would describe as strategy. So it could be, you know, low carbohydrate training,
sure.
High intensity interval training. Did a great one with Martin Gibala on that. But it is, and my catchword, if you may or may not know, is context. It is, you know, to put that another way, it that strategy is a tool in the toolbox that you whip that tool out at an appropriate time for an appropriate purpose. And
absolutely.
Yeah, it is. And I, that's why I like what you said. And I've read this in several of your papers where you've quite clearly said it's an acute thing. It's not a chronic thing. And yet when you, I mean, I haven't spent a long time on this because I've kind of only come across this fairly recently. But when I have looked around on the internet to see what there is on this, of course, you're seeing people talking about dedicating entire workouts to this methodology, which simply means they don't understand their strategy. So that's kind of the purpose of this is to discuss what it is, and let's unpack this a bit into the real world so that the listeners can understand what the strategy is, how to use it, and when to use it, possibly.
Sure.
And of course, go on.
Yeah, no, if you're a trained person, you know, which is, you know, probably the majority of your listeners who are working out, who are healthy, who can use high loads, then this is, could you only use blood flow restriction with low loads and be okay? Probably. But it makes more sense to train with high loads and use this as a supplement if you want to. You know, the thing that I always say is you don't have to use blood flow restriction if you don't want to. I like your phrasing where you say it's a tool in the toolbox. There's no doubt that, you know, high load training works, but it's also very stressful to the system. So if you can kind of tie that in and use a little bit of blood flow restriction to not tax it quite as much, but still get the similar benefit, then that's a great utilization of blood flow restriction.
Sure.
Right? It may be a way to, you know, increase your frequency of training throughout the week, which is something that, you know, our lab's kind of getting really interested in because I think the frequency of the training, not only with blood flow restriction, but just in general, is something that's been overlooked for years.
Mm. Yeah. I mean, the thing that I guess what I'm really interested in as I straddle these sort of physiology and metabolic type and nutrition and all that stuff sort of topics is there's clearly a need to, as I said there, you know, identify what those strategies are and then learn how and when to use them, which of course we would better describe this as some sort of integrative periodization between training and nutrition. And, you know, I guess there's some for listeners that are looking for some more research, you know, these studies on blood flow restriction, you could also possibly look at how various nutrition interventions could influence this potentially. Maybe we could talk about some ideas in a second, but let's just unpack this a bit then. So can you take us into a bit more detail then about, you know, what these proposed adaptive responses and the potential mechanisms that underpin this blood flow restriction training concept?
Well, with low load resistance training, you know, we can just focus on that because that's going to give you the biggest magnitude, which is, you know, probably
sure.
What your listeners care about. I really think there's something to pulling those metabolites around the muscle. So you're getting this metabolic stress, you know, you're kind of bathing the muscle in metabolites. So there might be something special with that, but that also might augment some of the mechanical activation. So, you know, we're starting off at 20 and 30% of your max. So you're starting off around 30% of your max activation. But by the end of that exercise, you're at 90, 95%. So it augments it a lot because you're restricting blood flow during the rest periods as well. So all of that recovery that normally happens, that isn't happening. So you're not only are you might be getting, you know, some benefit from bathing those metabolites, but it also is just making it harder to recover to where you're recruiting more and more and more of those type 2 fibers in addition to type 1 just to be able to lift the load. So I think, you know, as far as integrating this into a training program, a lot of times when they're using this with like a practical model of blood flow restriction, where they're just using the knee wraps, which is something we proposed, you know, back in 2008, 2009. You know, there's chronic data showing that that's beneficial in well-trained athletes. So they did this in American football players. They've done it two or three times now, where they do their traditional training. One group did their normal traditional training, and they followed it up with low load blood flow restriction. The other group did their normal traditional training, followed up with just the repetitions. So low load repetitions, no blood flow restriction. And what they saw was an augmentation in strength in the squat and bench press. So that, you know, that tells me that it's not just the volume. So there's something going on with blood flow restriction that was augmenting that response. So there's obvious, obviously you have to keep it in context, which is what you were saying. If you're going in, you're blasting the muscle, and you've already maxed out that muscle's response, adding blood flow restriction on top of that. So if you've done like three exercises for your chest or your legs or whatever, and then you add blood flow restriction, are you going to get that much more of an augmentation? I doubt it. You know, I mean, a muscle can only respond, you know, so much. Mm-hmm. But I do think it's a tool that might be able to be implemented by many people who are trained by following their exercise with a couple exercises of blood flow restriction, or they can use it when they're injured, or they can use it when they, you know, maybe just don't have it in mentally in the gym that day. It's safer to use low lows and just get the workout done versus trying to force yourself to use 80 and 90% of your 1RM and, you know, potentially get injured. So I definitely think there's quite a few implications.
Absolutely. So, you know, as I've read into this, you know, there's a couple of things that appear to be obviously occurring due to the restriction of blood flow in. There's going to be a reduction in oxygen going in, so that's going to result in some sort of hypoxia, right? So what is the potential role of hypoxia in this situation, you think?
Well, it's kind of interesting, because you would think that the muscle is becoming hypoxic, and there's some indication with NEARS that it might be, but there's other indications that it might not be. Mm. It's really kind of mind-boggling, honestly. But they're with that hypoxia, if it is occurring, or even if it, you know, there's some alteration in the oxygen kinetics somehow, which seems probable, you know, that may have benefits for fiber type recruitment. It may have benefits for stimulating, you know, VEGF, which is important for, you know, angiogenesis, you know, the vascular network. Mm. It may also have implications for one of the things that's been seen out of, you know, Scandinavia by Matthias Wernbaum's group, is that they see a huge proliferation of satellite cells and rapid muscle growth in, you know, in 3 weeks. And hypoxia might be able to, you know, be linked with that in some way as well. So I think there's probably something going on with oxygen on some level. And I think that could drive, you know, any one of those.
Sure.
For beneficial adaptations. And I just want to touch real quickly, because
yeah.
I don't want to get my words twisted around, like always happens on this. So we're talking about this. It's an acute thing, right? So what we're referring to is, this is acute blood flow restriction, meaning we're restricting blood flow for minutes, not hours. Mm. The benefit that you see isn't just, so some people have said repeatedly, well, it's only short-term swelling, you know, that it goes back to baseline as soon as you leave. That's not true at all. This is producing meaningful changes in muscle size. Now, you know, I commented on Twitter before where they go, well, the gains seen with blood flow restriction are only acute, or they only last a short time. That's true for all training, as if you don't continue to train, right? I've never known any stimulus where you get muscle and then you just stop training and it stays there for the rest of your life, right? Mm. So the acute stimulus we're talking about is with blood flow restriction. The muscle size and strength gains last for a period of time. So it does lead to true chronic adaptation. The acute response is referring only to restricting blood flow for minutes, not hours.
Right. So because I relatively recently have been introduced to the wonders of the molecular stuff that's going on here and signaling and so on, the area that does seem to be really interesting in all this is, by virtue of doing this blood flow restriction training properly, which we'll discuss the uses of cuffs and correct ways to do this, but clearly there's you're allowing blood flow in, but you're restricting its ability to leave, which obviously means that there's a greater accumulation of metabolites. Sure. That are occurring in this environment. And, I've heard this referred to by multiple guests on this, where there are all kinds of things that occur in response to that buildup of metabolites and or the ways in which those metabolites might interfere with either the biochemistry or the molecular signaling type stuff that's going on. I mean, what do you feel is going on at that level?
That's a good question. I think it does appear to be that, the increase in, now there's a recent paper out by Gunderman that is, basically demonstrated that the increase in muscle protein synthesis is mTOR dependent to some level. Because when they blocked it, the elevation wasn't there. So there does appear to be augmentation of those anabolic mTOR ceiling cascades. There also is a downregulation of myostatin, even a little bit more than what you would see with high load training. Whether or not that is meaningful, you have to ask somebody else, but that that has been observed as well. So, we're honestly not really sure. I can tell you that they see some, at 8 hours post, they see a downregulation in some of these proteolytic markers. Whether or not that's meaningful, that's another question. They see with resistance training with blood flow restriction, a very large proliferation of myogenic stem cells, so satellite cells, that does appear to be meaningful for long-term changes in muscle size by, maintaining the myonuclear domain. There does appear to be a downregulation of myostatin, following chronic training. A similar adaptation that occurs with high load training. How meaningful is that for driving the response? We're not really sure. We also have some retrospective data that suggests that cell swelling component, so the swelling of a muscle might be related to muscle growth. For example, we had one arm do concentric blood flow restriction. The other arm did the same repetitions, but they did eccentric blood flow restriction. Concentric blood flow restriction results in a greater increase in acute swelling, and that led to greater increases in muscle size. Is that good evidence? Not really. That's retrospective, but it supports that cell swelling might be important on some level. But again, how important is it? We're not really sure, right? So there's a combination of several things that are observed, but as it is with traditional training, it's very hard to put all those pieces together. Gunderman, they also looked at, in addition to looking at protein synthesis, it was the first study that actually measured protein breakdown, and they didn't see any change at all. But again, maybe it was a time point thing. You're limited by whenever you take the biopsy, whenever you're looking at that snapshot. It's possible that maybe the increase in protein breakdown occurred earlier, or it's possible that the load is so low that it's not augmenting it at all. Right. So,
sure. Look, firstly, I guess it's early days really, isn't it? You're able to see that this methodology appears to work. I guess the both your own lab, but also the wider research community can get involved to understand the mechanisms. And I'm sure that will happen, over time. So, you know, as I mentioned, I've done a bit of research on this, and I've looked around and I've seen some interesting blogs by people who are showing pictures of themselves doing squats and deadlifts. So, you know, that what springs to mind is when I look at the evidence, it seems to be low intensity exercise and so on. And I'm guessing it's just people misinterpreting the research. But the exercise stimulus is obviously a factor here whilst you're actually restricting the blood flow. So tell us more about the relevance of the type of exercise in this situation.
Yeah. So, you know, there is data showing that it can increase squat, you know, or it's been used in the squat. It's been used in several different exercises. I don't know that I would use it in a traditional deadlift. I'm not sure that makes sense. But, you know, it's interesting because, you know, the model that we usually use in our lab is we usually use the arm curl, we use a knee extension. It's a very easy model to control. But, you know, the amount of exercises that's been done on is, you know, quite a bit, squat, bench, which we can talk about that here in a second because that's indirect blood flow restriction. But squat, you know, bench, knee extension, leg press, leg curl, etc. But you're definitely right in that, you know, the purpose of blood flow restriction, excuse me, is to use low loads. There's no good evidence suggesting that applying blood flow restriction with high load training augments that response at all. We're moving into some ideas where we can maybe try to augment that a little bit, but there's no evidence showing conclusively that, you know, training at a high loads in combination with blood flow restriction is better than just training with high loads, right? So my response always is if you want to train with high loads, then just train with high loads. The only reason why we would restrict blood flow is to train with low loads, right? To match the high load atmosphere. But, you know, one of the things that people run into when they try to research this in a lab is that it's incredibly difficult to restrict blood flow and then have them do high loads because they can't do the work, or two, it's so painful that they can't do the work, right? Yeah. So, you know, it makes no sense to me currently to ever apply this with a high load. You know, from a safety standpoint especially, all the safety data on it showing that it's beneficial and safe is done with low loads.
So what about we've talked about exercise load and such, but the training volume itself, I know you sort of tipped into that, but how relevant is volume? I mean, are we talking one set? Are we talking once a week? I mean, what's the sort of the volume and frequency of this?
That's, you know, like I always tell people, that's an incredibly impossible question to answer. because, you know, the stimulus that we use in the lab, you know, is we use the standard, you know, quote unquote standard protocol. First set, 30 repetitions, three sets of 15 following it with 30 seconds rest in between. You know, 1 second concentric action, 1 second eccentric action. So the question becomes, do you require 30, 15, 15, 15? And I think the answer is probably not. But it's one of those things where the protocol is used repeatedly and shown to be beneficial repeatedly, that you never really want to put all the resources into a study to study it any shorter, right? Mm-hmm. And then run into the question of, well, we're not really sure because, you know, we're also trying to match what's been done at the mechanistic level. So we wouldn't want to do a study done with mechanisms doing 30, 15, 15, 15, and then we do, you know, 15 reps and then have no idea what's going on. Yeah. But I think volume is important. Okay. One of the things that, you know, I will have a better picture of in the next couple of years is how important is it? And that's something that our lab is really getting interested in. It's one of those things where I think it's evident that volume is an important driver of muscle growth. But I think the threshold, you know, we always talk about once you surpass a threshold, that you've probably maximized the response of that muscle for that workout session. So the magic question is, what's the threshold? And I think it's probably a little different between each individual based on training status, based on you know, a lot of things. But I think it's what I'm starting to see in our lab is that I think the volume threshold, you know, at least what I'm seeing right now is probably a little bit less than what we expected. And, you know, we've tested this through some of our collaborations where we had one group do 30, 15, 15, 15. We had another group do 30, 15, 15, 15, rest for 5 minutes, and then do the same thing again. And then we compared that to high-low training. And what we saw is that all the results were the same, meaning that, you know, adding that extra volume didn't augment the response at all. So the question now is, how low can you go and still get benefit? And that's kind of the difficult part. And it gets even more difficult when you're trying to, you know, talk about when I get emails from people, you know, who are saying, well, I train with high loads. How could I implement this in, you know, to match the volume, et cetera. And what I would tell them is, you know, it's very difficult to just be like, here, this is exactly what it is. Right. But I think, you know, you could reasonably expect if you're doing a couple exercises per body part, you know, do one of them normally and then follow it with another exercise with blood flow restriction, and then that would be good. Or the way I would always implement it with myself is I would do a traditional day where maybe I do high load, traditional upper body, you know, and then I would follow it with low load blood flow restriction of the lower body. Then the next day I would do traditional lower body exercise, following it with blood flow restriction of the upper body. Right. So there's a lot of different ways to implement it. But I guess the point is, if you're doing five or six exercises with traditional training, as some people do still, I'm not sure why, but you know, some people just like to go in there and just blast it. Yeah. If you do that and then add in blood flow restriction, are you really going to augment the response at all? Probably not. But you know, I'm not sure, but I wouldn't bet money on it.
Sure. Because when you read the research, the vast majority of the research that examines the low load resistance exercise with blood flow restriction uses relatively brief interset rest periods. I noticed. I mean, is that a particularly relevant issue here?
You know, a lot of, you know, we always use 30 seconds. Some people use a minute. We see 30 seconds as being pretty beneficial. Is it better or worse than a minute? I'm not really sure. But one of the things that, you know, I didn't mention the last time is that, we talked about volume, but frequency throughout the week, you can train with low loads and blood flow restriction very frequently, much more frequently than you can with high load training. Because the stress and the recovery required from it is very low, you know, very low. Meaning that you could, you know, if you look at some of these studies, you know, they use blood flow restriction 3 or 4 times a week for the same muscle group. So implementing that with, you know, people who are already doing high-low training, that's where I was getting back with, you know, maybe you do 2 times a week normal, 2 times a week with blood flow restriction. But you'd have to kind of play around with it a little bit to find what's really kind of quote-unquote optimal for your lifestyle. But
sure, yeah, I mean, that sort of plays well into what I was saying earlier about the importance of periodization and this being a strategy, and like you say, you know, it's a strategy that doesn't necessarily, or it doesn't increase the amount of stress on the individual or the athlete, and in a time in their season or year or whatever, where they are undergoing more stress, either through competition or, you know, they're an outdoor athlete and there's a lot of cold weather performance or whatever, this is something that potentially plays a role in that, in the coach's toolbox of things that can be used, which is a perfect segue, actually, into my next sort of area I wanted to delve into, which is the practical applications of this. And sure. When I was reading all the research, I mean, one area that I thought that was of really fairly obvious use for this is with those people that aren't able to do high load or high intensity types of training, which is going to be either sort of elderly people or those that are involved in some sort of rehabilitation type type program. So talk us through about how this, practically speaking, how this can be applied to the elderly and, you know, injury rehab. Sure.
You know, there's been some data, you know, looking at this, but, you know, we've done studies on the elderly, you know, and to be honest with you, they love it. They absolutely love it. And when you compare it to, you know, some of the responses we get from when they do high-low training, they must, not across the board, obviously, but the vast majority of them prefer blood flow restriction. They do not like lifting heavy weights all the time, you know, across the board. You know, obviously some people prefer, you know, whatever. But it does have, you know, some interesting application for that. You know, we did it with elastic bands in combination with blood flow restriction, and saw some benefits in the upper body and older postmenopausal women. There's been some data in the literature on ACL tears. Following ACL reconstruction surgery, you know, applying blood flow restriction, that's where they saw the, you know, the attenuation and the loss of atrophy. Or attenuated and the loss of muscle mass. So they're, you know, following any type of surgery or following some type of mobilization, this might be, depending on the circumstance, might be a way to actually see some benefits. You know, I just had a meeting last week. I serve as kind of a scientific advisor for the Center for the Intrepid. It's a center for kind of rehabilitation in the United States where they send a lot of blast trauma soldiers. And they're seeing just some incredible things. You know, he's been making the news a lot. It's kind of been moving over into the NFL, the American football, and the NBA. You know, there's a lot of interest from people in the United States about this implementation now from the, you know, from a rehabilitation standpoint. You know, they're very, very interested in this data. And, you know, just talking with him and talking with a few other people who I know are using this in their clinics in the United States, you know, they're seeing tremendous benefit. And, you know, it's one of those things where I get a lot of people emailing me on a weekly basis telling me about how they're using rehabilitation successfully. You know, they're using it in their clinics. And you know, I'm always very cautious because, you know, those aren't well-controlled situations, right? But when it matches up with the literature and when you hear enough of it, you know, at some point you have to ask yourself, you have to say that there's seems to be an enormous clinical application here that's being, you know, favorably applied with minimal to no side effects. So I do think that for the athlete, if there's ever a situation where, you know, they cannot lift heavy, you know, maybe you don't like blood flow restriction normally, but maybe it's a time where it can allow you to train to get back to lifting heavy weights. Maybe that's another, you know, context where you could use that tool. You can't lift weights right now with heavy, you know, at a high load. So perhaps you can do this and get the body ready to where it can lift that. And then maybe you don't have to do blood flow restriction anymore if you don't want to. But maybe that's a tool where you can use that. So there's definitely across the board, I would say clinically,
yeah,
there's huge implications for this. Especially, you know, think about surgery where they have people. You know, Van Loon has shown this a couple times recently where, you know, following kind of bed rest, which is what happens in a lot of these hospitals, you lose tremendous amount of muscle mass. Mm-hmm. So if there's a situation where perhaps there you could maybe you would still probably lose it, but maybe you could slow it down. I mean, the implication would be huge.
It's exciting, really exciting.
Absolutely.
So another area, you've made me think of a few things, which has the danger of making this podcast go on for too long. But basically, we've discussed the relevance of this in a variety of scenarios. And for healthy athletes, of course, there's a time and a place for this, as we've said many times in our sort of context-specific sort of way. But an area that I think could be useful perhaps, and maybe you could elaborate on this, is in this area that is concurrent training, where of course athletes are trying to do multiple types of training in a given day. I mean, what do you think that there's a role for it in concurrent training?
Yeah, you know, perhaps, you know, there's a recent study out of Brazil from Carlos Jurgenowicz's lab. He's a really big, good researcher in this area, Phil, as well. And, they, I'm trying to remember correctly, but they, there was an older people, but they did traditional aerobic exercise. And they had one group do traditional aerobic exercise with high load training, and another group do traditional aerobic exercise with blood flow, with low load blood flow restriction training. And kind of their hypothesis was that the adding in that high load would, that there would be an interference there. Ultimately, they didn't see a difference between groups. But what's interesting to me is that, if I'm remembering correctly, the blood flow restriction group was able to use a lot less volume with the resistance training. So it may be an interesting tool to try. I there's with concurrent training where they've exclusively looked at that, there's only one study. But I do think it's an interesting way to implement it. And I know some people have used it in kind of the bodybuilding world where, when they do their cardio on some days, they do the cardio under restriction. Is that going to benefit them? Hypothetically, but I'm not sure how big of a response that would be.
Sure. Well, we often see bodybuilders doing some very odd things in the gym. This would just be another odd thing that they can do.
There's no doubt about that.
Yeah, yeah. So, correct me if I'm... Well, actually, no, before I say that, and this is important, so I'm pleased I didn't forget this, but what would the potential limitations and contraindications for this be then?
Oh, for blood flow restriction?
Yeah.
I think, obviously, if your sport is like powerlifting, specificity is always going to be king. So, this would be a tool that you could perhaps use in your training program. But if you're exclusively using blood flow restriction, and then you're going to expect to go and squat, a large 1RM or a bench, a large 1RM, having trained exclusively at low loads, you're going to lose that meet, right? So, specificity holds. Some of the contraindications of, when someone might not want to do this, two of the main concerns that people always have, anytime we're doing research studies, we always have to address these, is muscle damage and blood clotting, both of which haven't, we have tried several times to look at this, and we have never observed marked measurable changes in muscle damage using protocols that are used in the literature. When they look at blood clotting cascades, they're not activated. So it's suggestive that it's not, activating any system that would lead to or increase your risk of blood clotting. With that being said, if you're at a higher risk for thromboembolism, maybe you've had situations in your family where someone's had pulmonary embolism or thromboembolism, and maybe you're at a high risk. Maybe it's not something to do. We don't have data on that, but it's just kind of trying to use your brain a little bit. If you have impaired vascular, if you have an impaired vascular system, there's no data whatsoever that would show that it would be detrimental. But I probably wouldn't apply blood flow restriction to someone who has abnormal vasculature, right?
Yeah.
If someone has had lymph nodes removed, they usually don't allow blood pressure to be taken on that side of the arm. So again, there's no data, but I probably wouldn't recommend doing blood flow restriction either, because maybe you could pull some of that in some of the lymph, and it could cause some issues. We don't have data, but it's just something that to be safe. So those are the big ones. Obviously, pregnancy, we've never studied that. But
try getting ethics for that study.
No question. One of the things that, just the pregnancy in general, there's a lot of crazy exercise recommendations for you can't do this, you can't do that. But, with that being said, because some people are like, well, there's no data behind that recommendation, to really limit a pregnant woman to this or intensity or that intensity. You know, and I understand that, but I also understand that, you know, there's certain things that why risk it? You know, why? You know, if you want to use blood flow restriction that bad, just wait. You know, it's not to say that you would do it and something bad would happen, but what if it did? You know, and I don't know. I just think that there's certain times where you have to just be very cautious regardless.
Yeah. Well, look, I mean, you know, I think we've covered about as much as we can reasonably in the space of 45 minutes so far. There's a great deal more to be read on this, and I know that you're going to continue to research this, and perhaps next year or the year after we'll come back and see what's new.
I do want to just say one last thing.
You
know, because a lot of people have a lot of questions about how much restriction do we need? And there's very preliminary data from our lab, but we have a pretty good indication that higher pressures aren't better, meaning that it doesn't have to be as tight as possible to see benefit. We're seeing benefits with, you know, about 40 to 50% of what it takes to call off blood flow. So very moderate pressure. So higher is not necessarily better. We have no data showing that. We actually have data showing that the results from pretty low pressure to pretty high pressure are pretty similar. So just keep that in mind.
Yeah, no, absolutely. And I'm going to direct folks to how they can contact you or more specifically find out more about your work and your research. Do you have a website specifically? Or I know you have a Twitter. Let's start with your Twitter. What can folks, how can they find you on Twitter?
So just you can go to Twitter at JPLOENNEKE. So brilliant. That's where the best way to contact me. I don't have any products to sell, but that's the, if you want to get a hold of me, Twitter is the best place.
Yeah, sure. And obviously there's a ton of research that you've done, and you've also done some good stuff in the nutrition fields. And I loved your case study that you're involved with, the bodybuilding prep. My group we've got a paper in review with a journal also about bodybuilding prep. So,
nice.
Yeah, I love case studies. There's a lot of great research being done, but not so much research looking at how this stuff ends up in the real world. And I know that N-of-1 is not the highest form of evidence, but it's still important to follow this stuff into the real world. So I love case studies. So,
yeah, I think, you know, this bodybuilding thing, I think, you know, the only way to study that is through a case study.
Yeah.
But I think there's a lot of things that we can learn about diet and the response from studying these some of these bodybuilders. But no, I agree. It's fascinating stuff. You know, we followed a bodybuilder who was actually in our lab. You know, we followed him for quite some time. It was Lindy Rosso. This kind of idea. And we saw some of the most bizarre physiologic changes. You know, and I've observed, you know, when I dieted, I observed many of the same. You know, we're obviously two different bodybuilders. This guy's, you know, obviously if you look at the paper, this guy's very, very large, very, very strong, and obviously a pro. So I'm much more mediocre than that. But, you know, I still think some of the same physiologic responses occur.
Yeah, well, I think, and we can end it on this really, I think that it is important to make that distinction that when we're working with people, we're working with an individual or a group of individuals with very specific individual needs that we need to customize our approaches to their individual needs, desires, outcomes, physiology, psychology, and all that stuff. But when we read research and papers, you know, because most of those papers, they often don't include all of the data in there, you sometimes forget that a lot of the data is the mean, you know, the average of what they're finding. It doesn't necessarily represent that individual, and particularly with elite athletes who often can be the outlier.
Sure.
And I certainly find all that stuff fascinating. But that's for another podcast. So
yes.
I really appreciate your time today, Jeremy. It's been awesome. I've learned loads just from that. And I know the folks will be very appreciative. And as I said, they can learn more and read your papers and so on by looking for those in scientific journals, etc. But that brings us to the end of this Guru Performance We Do Science podcast. You can learn more about the podcast at guruperformance.com. Also about the ISSN Diploma Postgraduate Program that I lead, and the Master of Science and Sports Nutrition Program that I lead at the University of Middlesex in London. And Jeremy, you also, you're not just researching, you're also teaching, aren't you? Where, if people want to come study with you, where can they do that?
Yeah, you know, look me up at the University of Mississippi. We're in the Department of Health, Exercise Science, and Recreation Management in the School of Applied Sciences. So I have quite a few very good students right now, but, you know, we're always looking for more. So,
fantastic.
Yeah, check us out there.
Great. Okay. Well, thanks, mate. And that brings us to the end. And I, of course, am Laurel Bannock. Talk to you all again soon.